Accession number 28455, Reel 6.
John Davis, Reel 6. So how did you end your war?
Well, I was... all this training of others, I wanted to do more. And I applied... Now, I had this Uncle Lionel of mine, my father's youngest brother, had been several years behind the lines. He'd escaped from the Hong Kong takeover by the Japanese. He'd escaped and gone into China, and he's good at Mandarin, and he got into behind the lines work just as he was a volunteer like me, an ordinary private. But he did very good, clever man, and he went to Brigadier, working behind the lines with my first cousin Arthur, the two of them both Mandarin speakers. And I met him in London now and then, Lionel, on his visits, and he put me in touch with a man from some secret SOE world who I was interviewed by in Piccadilly in a big house there, and I had adequate Mandarin. I'd mugged up Mandarin, and he thought I could join this group. There's Lionel there. They were based in India, and they flew over the hump and went to China to and fro at great risk. If caught, they'd be instantly beheaded, sort of thing. Working for the Chinese and the British against the Japanese. And I was accepted and left Scotland and went to Baker Street in London and was given some training in opening how to open mail without it being noticed. And various tricks on the telephone and ways of... dealing in subterfuge for quite a while, and I saw some really glamorous women back from France, all sunburnt, who'd been dropped behind the lines and come back to this. It was the head office of these sort of things. And I was about to go and be posted. I was put through the posting orders, came through and everything. Then the atom bomb fell. And then they said, well, if you want to do this sort of work, you've got to sign on for 4 years. And you're not a... And my father-in-law, who was in it, regular army doctor, first war man, said, look here, this isn't right. You're not a regular soldier. It's not your career. You're going to waste 4 years of your business, and you married my daughter. So you better not do it. You know, sign on for 4 years as a non-soldier. So I pulled out. Came back to Scotland headquarters, and from there they posted me to... I wanted to go overseas and do something. To... Hanover, a village north of Hanover called Burgdorf, northeast of Hanover, where they were dealing with displaced persons from the war. It was category B, we were B category officers, about 14 of us, in a big Schloss, which is the name of a German mansion. And the squire of the Schloss was there still, and we made him chop the firewood. We thought that's great fun. He was sort of grand squire, but he was chopping off firewood. Anyhow, we lived there, and there were two Russian officers there and three medical officers, and we were putting these people on their continuing life journey, what skills they had, where their families were, getting them fitter, feeding them up, and they were all in tented camps, and we were in this great Schloss.
Yes, were they from concentration camps?
Some were concentration camp people, yes, they were. Belsen was quite nearby up there, and others were just displaced. They'd been bombed out of Romania, Poland, Latvia, Estonia, all these sort of people floating about without jobs, without homes, half fed, scattered and bringing up people altogether. Few women, mostly men, and we interviewed them and talked about them and administered them, got them real or arranged in their life in a way. The medical officers checked them and put them on healing things, but the two Russian officers were there also interviewing them and talking to them, and they were looking for traitors or prisoners which had fought for the Germans and didn't want to but had, and those were, and they sent them straight back to Russia to be shot. We knew that was going on, but they joined in all our ENSAR army entertainments and came to our cinemas and rolled with laughter with us and drank and danced and dances. You know, jolly chaps, but they were about this wicked business.
Yeah, so I suppose they were sending people back against their will, were they?
They were, yes.
How did you feel about that? You know, was there any policy so far as the British were concerned?
We weren't, there was news politically later I read that we were not strong enough about that. We should have stopped them. We shouldn't have had them there. And we had a British colonel in this household with us. I was a captain then. We shouldn't have taken them under our wing to let them do this sort of thing. They were there to find out people they suspected and try to kill them, you know, out of sight back in Russia somewhere. So it was that sort of life, very harsh winter. We went boar shooting now and then. There were wild boars up there. Quite a useful job, I felt. And then...
Were there any problems did you have with the job? You know, can you remember any detail of it? And, you know, these people were in tents, you say.
Yes. We did get some hutted camps before the winter came on. Because it was a very severe winter. I had chilblains. It was very, very cold. Yes, most of them went into hutted camps later. That's right.
Yes. Did you have any problems with them? You know, they were mixed nationalities.
They were.
I imagine.
We had interpreters. Some of them, of these civilians, could speak English. And they had special interpreting positions. The Poles, most of them were Polish. Czechs, Romanians, all those sort of scattered and broken up people by the war. Mostly finding out what skills they had, what jobs they had done before it all happened. I don't remember too much about it, I'm ashamed to say. I seen that they got enough rations. We found out that they could be sent to factories down in Lower Germany. Yes, we tried to get them placed into work. And in a healthy state of life again. And there are cleverer people, there are intelligence officers there, who set about finding the rest of their families, as far as I could make out, their wives. And so it was a muddled up time in my mind. I'm not so clear about it, but we did work to save their, put them back into the world, as it were.
Did you ever go to any of the concentration camps yourself?
No, I didn't. No. They came in batches on train loads to Hanover, and there's a train at Bergdorf actually station, and a few lorry loads. I had a lovely Mercedes car. When we arrived, you said you can have a car. It's been commandeered for you chaps. So I went down, found a black Mercedes with red up Hill Street. It's marvellous. So I didn't have an army vehicle anymore. I had a commandeered German car, which is
probably from some big Nazi.
Yeah, some big victory prize, as far as I was concerned.
Were you involved in any way with the denazification program?
No, we had, of course, a non-frat rule, strongly kept, no fraternizing.
Was it kept?
Some people had German girlfriends, I will admit. I went dancing with some now and then. Some had more serious affairs with German, young German women. We were not supposed to do that, or to speak to the men at all.
What sort of state was Germany in?
Well, Hanover, where I went in an RAF plane sitting on the floor. A bunch of us were flown over there, just sitting in the fuselage of the thing, the body of the thing. Hanover was absolutely wrecked. Great big city, piles of bricks and broken stuff around all over the place. Yes. Now when I went in May this year, great bustling modern city with wide highways and trams and everything beautiful and highly Germany efficient. But when I left it, it was quite a shambles. Worse than London, I would say. It was really bombed.
How about the German people? What sort of state were they in? The ordinary German civilians?
They were pretty humble. They were sort of humble. Many could speak English. I found then, I mean, and now they all speak English in this day and age. And on the railways now, you perhaps know, the trains are all announced in German and English. Which is strange, not French, right? German and English. All the train coming, I went with a friend. I went under the Hero's Return system, which is, you know, that the lottery and MOD grant. My £500 has come through since for my trip there just now to revisit. We didn't notice them much. We were quite removed. I didn't know a word of German. I wouldn't do that today. I'd get to learn it. But then I didn't dream of such a thing.
What was it like going back on the Hero's Return? Was it meaningful for you?
Yes, it was. It was a bit odd because it was a one-off ski. You see, a friend of mine was in the Navy, lives in Milford. He's gone with 22 others on the Dunkirk business. I went as a solo with this friend of mine, a woman friend, since my wife died 15 years ago. And we were too old for it. It's jolly hard work in your 80s, these great big stations. We had to change at Brussels, change at Cologne, and arrive at Hanover and find the hotel. But people came and saved us.
Yes, were you looked after by the people of Hanover? You know, was that the idea, that they would sort of look after you and take you about?
No, it was. I went as a solo, as a one. You see, if you'd gone as a group, it would have been different. But I was just an officer amongst there were gunners and engineers and other regiments officers doing this task. So we went a unit. I don't know who they are or where they are, so I just went as myself.
So no one would have known you?
No one would have known me. But luckily we found our third angel was, a taxi driver in Bergdorf, grand young man. And he took us to a shop where they knew Hanover of the past. Older people were there and they said, yes, it's up that way, and he drove us to it.
That was your plant, was it? The slot, oh yes. Yes, you were living in very grand style.
Grand style. And yes. I've got a picture of it today. It's been bought by an Iranian oil millionaire, if you please. And it's been painted grey. But it was all grand red brick then in those years. there are all the flat fields with the trees growing. There were all the tents were in the hutted camps. No old fields, trees. So I did get there and had the feeling of 60 years ago, it's 1945. It'd be a worthwhile journey, well worth. And as I spoke to you on the phone, I've been asked by them whether I want to go and speak to schools or do this or do that. I haven't filled the form in yet, because filling in forms is I have to get help with. Well worth. I'll write to our regimental gazette about it. I belong to the regimental association. We have a gazette. So I'll write an article to them, I think, about it, really. So it was rather, in that way, a failure. It wasn't a group thing. Always after I've been in a campaign, you see, it was an odd situation. But I enjoyed it, and it was well rewarded, I felt.
That was the main thing, I would think, wouldn't you? You know,
yes.
How you sort of reacted to it.
Yes.
Now, after the war, I understand you went back into the remnants of the empire. Is this it with your work?
Well, yes. I went through the same uncle who was met us in China, in Dunlop. He was in Dunlop in China. It was quite hard to get work coming out of the as an army officer. Very hard. I wrote everywhere, far and wide. Could speak Mandarin. I've had some little training in the stock exchange. Finally, this Uncle Lionel got me into Dunlop's. So I went to Birmingham. We lived on Tower Hill, where my wife's uncle was Tubby Clayton, the founder of Tock H.
Oh, really?
And the Talbot House, we lived there opposite the Tower of London.
Oh, right. Yes, this is a very famous man, isn't
yes,
he?
Yes, Tubby, there's a picture of him up there. His church was on the tower, all hands by the tower.
Yes, would he have been alive then?
Yes. Yes, he was running Tock H. He was running, he had his office there. And my wife, Joan, became his sort of social secretary.
Oh.
Because he's forever having people to lunch, from royalty down to the street sweeper. And they came to the Tock H Mark, they were called Marks, where young men lived while they were learning a business. And before they could afford housing, Tock H had houses in which they lodged them like dormitories. Tubby formed it after the war. And that was her uncle. So she minded him on Tower Hill, And I went to Birmingham by train every Monday and worked in Dunlop through the week, came back Friday evening. And then went for Dunlop's to India. I was going to China because of my Mandarin, but I met one of the Dunlop, one of the Indian directors in London, Birmingham. He took to me and said, well, I'd rather you came to my outfit in India. So I ended up in Calcutta, in Dunlop's. And there I was a young salesman. Above me was a very nice adhikari, an Indian, and two of the directors were Indians, and we went all over India. It was grand.
You were there at an interesting time, because this was 47, I think.
It was 47 when I arrived.
So you saw the independence.
Yes, I went first. I went arrived at the year of partition, August, the month of partition. Went to Delhi, the Delhi office of Dunlop's, which is in old Delhi, and suddenly riots broke out. The Hindus and the Muslims started to go for each other, and the British had withdrawn, and we were living in the Cecil Hotel, Delhi, and the Indian official said, you stay there and we're going to put troops around so you can't get out. So there's several of us foreigners, non-Indians, living in the Grand Old Hotel with swimming pool, tennis courts, evening fun and all that. So I got the hotel clerk and learned the language through the day. Luckily, I could speak Hindustani still. And that was useful. Then I went to Calcutta.
What did you see of the partition while you were in Delhi?
Yes, we were locked in. There were troops at the gate and everything, but we got out. A bunch of young Jerry Riddick, who'd been wounded in the desert, was there for the firm which prints banknotes. Well-known British firm which prints great printers. He was out there and a few of us got out somehow, went to the Delhi station. And there was a train which was just coming from the countryside, full of the wrong religion, I suppose, because it had been massacred. People were hanging out the windows and the doors and on the platform, dead and stabbed and exposed, and vultures on the roofs coming down to take picks at these corpses. So it was really Hindu-Muslim killings going on. Streets were all empty. You know, and at night things broke out, and so we were locked in to keep us out of the way, because we just handed over the British and they didn't want us embroiled at all. So we heard a lot, but we had this one expedition to the station where we really saw death and smelt it and hot Indian summer and all that. Yes.
How about Calcutta? Was there any trouble there?
No. Calcutta went much more smoothly. They'd gone to East Bengal, you see, which became East Pakistan, which became now Bangladesh. So that they were in a way hived off, and they had somewhere to quickly run to. Quite near Calcutta is Dhaka, which is Bangladesh capital. Then it was called East Bengal, and then East Pakistan, and now Bangladesh. And they said there weren't the troubles in Calcutta, and it's better policed, it seems to me, and it's a bigger city, and there's more control. Somehow.
How did you feel about that? You know, the British quitting India. What were your thoughts about that at the time?
I thought it had been a little bit hastened by Mountbatten and Attlee. I think they hurried it a bit too much. Maybe there'd been less turmoil if we'd gone more slowly at it. We suddenly left. Magistrates, police officers, there were two or three here retired British officers in the Indian police, all those sort of people went. Just overnight, we just pulled out, you know, like an evacuation. I think it was a bit too swift, and that may have contributed to the turmoil, really. I felt sad about it. My grandfather had been there, and my mother had been born there, my wife had been born there, my father-in-law was in the IMS, his whole career. There he is, there's a cartoon of him there, from captain to full colonel in the Indian Medical Service. And we had much connection with the country, the whole family, or many British did, of course. So we civilians felt sad about it. We realised our time was over, though.
Did you?
Yes. There was Churchill beginning to fail. Attlee was in charge. Churchill said, we're going to give away the empire, but we sort of felt it was going, I suppose. I felt I'd never get I'd just be a businessman. None of these are ministry jobs.
Yes, it's interesting when, you know, having said and described your school, where yes. you were all being groomed.
Yes, we were.
For these sort of imperial posts.
We were indeed. We were.
Yes, it must have been. Was it quite difficult psychologically for your generation to take on board, you know, the end of empire?
Yes. And now, you see, just last weekend my daughter's here talking to granddaughter. They found something about, my wife wrote a lot about, and she wrote an article about the empire ending and so on. And she gave a slight smile and maybe a little disapproving. The daughter, her generation, she's 52, of me. Isn't it weird? In one generation. Slightly disapproving. And I think not knowing enough about it, perhaps. She was born in Africa, in Morogoro, when we were there. My second son was born in India. So, I don't know why. It's not approved of. The print. It's going to take a while for us to get it brighter, I think. It's a great 250 years, I consider. But
yes, probably it's too soon for
too
historical
soon
analysis,
to be
isn't
appreciated.
It?
Yes, I
yes,
think so.
Yes.
They just think of the evil parts. Or they're not even really evil. I was there, as far as I was concerned, later, my second visit to India, providing great employment. Huge factories sorting mica when I became a mica buyer. I had to leave India because after 3 years, they really were Indianizing. I was quite an anomaly, anachronism. Young Englishman selling tires to Indians. They wanted a nice, fresh young Bengali. And of course, in he came, Mr. Dutta, took my car, took my flat and everything. You know, we handed over and left. And they said, go home, go to the UK branch. And I said, no, I'd rather leave. So I sailed to Africa. Sent my wife home. Our big house was next door here. The big house next to this was the in-laws' house, where they'd retired to. And while she came back to the parents, I looked for work in Africa. And called at Mombasa, where I had a cousin farming, and went on to Beira, and into Africa, into southern Rhodesia, Zimbabwe now, and started trying tobacco farming. In fact, it wasn't at all my scene. So I advertised, and the dear old ex-colonel from the First War, with the monocle and the gunner tie, interviewed me in the big hotel in Salisbury, Harare, today, and engaged me in this mica business. This stuff is mica, which is an underground mineral.
Oh, yes.
Which is nature's marvellous insulator.
Oh, really?
It stops thousands of volts.
Yes.
And enormous heat.
Really? Is it used today, mica?
It's only, this is low quality, you see. It was used till about 20 years ago.
Oh.
Now it's only used in the space program, in battleships, and in really important things, the top quality ruby mica, which is pink colour, because it cannot break down. Absolutely marvellous. Thousands of volts, and it just stays inert. It's a silicate mined underground. So I went up with him. He took me up to Tanganyika, where there was wanting somebody in the branch, and I joined it there.
That would be, Tanganyika would be the new Tanzania.
It is.
Oh, right. There again, you must have been there at this changeover time.
Yes, arrived in 1950 and had a great life. Learned Swahili again, you know, Eastern languages came my way in order to do the job, to speak properly with people. A big factory with 200 Africans sorting and grading mica. And my English boss then went to the States, so I became the head manager, super Bengali assistant, good Bengali accountant, and several senior Africans and 200 men sorting and grading. This has to be reduced to a certain thickness and have all the faults and cracks cut out. And these men were doing that, sitting at tables with knives. Just can't do it by machinery. So it's a great employer in countries where they have huge labour forces.
Oh, yes, it sounds ideal, doesn't it? Labour-intensive,
yes,
third-world countries.
Exactly. It's grand
yes.
for the country, and we caused it to be exported all over the world.
And probably very environmentally friendly for countries like that.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Grand. Great job. Enjoyed it very much. Right through until 1963, when Uhuru, meaning freedom, broke out. We handed over. My wife has become, in 1956, she was elected a member of the Legislative Council. Tanganyika was a trust territory. The League of Nations asked us to look after it, which was exterminist Africa. So it wasn't a colony, it was a trust territory, TT, and to mind it until handover, till we could hand it over to the locals. And we did so without any fighting, and my wife was in the Legislative Council, which was the parliament of the place, on the government side, nominated. And I've got a letter here of her being stood down by the there, saying, "We appreciate your work and you may stand down now," sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, well.
Mm-hmm. She made
so that was, yes, a very responsible position.
Yes, there were three women.
Wife.
One
really?
White, yes. One Indian, one African.
Oh.
Nominated on the government side. The other side were elected mainly Africans.
Yes,
yes. The government side had the governor, which was then Twining. Handed over to Turnbull, and she was nominated and made several speeches in Hansard and so on. And there she is swearing at the mace. That pig. There, being sworn in.
Yes, oh, splendid, yes.
In Dar es Salaam.
Yes, you've got a good. What is the one of the Queen here? Is that anything?
That is my daughter in law,
mm-hmm.
who is the Prime Minister of New Zealand.
Oh,
my oldest son is married to Helen Clark.
Oh, really? But
who's the Prime Minister of New Zealand.
So really, I didn't...
Yes. That's Helen, and the Queen visiting some Commonwealth yes. Games or something. Yep.
Yes. Oh, well, that's very interesting.
And she's going for re-election
Helen Clark
now,
has
September.
Done very well, hasn't she?
Yes.
She's been very strong and outspoken.
Correct. She's raised the profile well, I think.
Yes.
Brought them into the
absolutely.
World.
Absolutely. And she's been
knowledge.
Very honest about things like the Iraq War.
Yes.
Very outspoken.
Outspoken, deep
yes.
masculine voice goes over well, sort of
yes.
thing.
Yes. Well, you've got a history then of strong women
I have.
In your family.
Correct. My
you?
Wife is a strong woman,
yes.
outspoken, made these speeches. Helen is. My mother's quiet little thing, but I then joined yoga in Britain and I've met strong women in the world of yoga. Natalie.
John Davis, end of reel 6.